So our subject, in case you haven't guessed by now today, is homelessness. It is a subject which was brought to our attention by people camping out at our front door. A problem which wasn't really a problem at all. At first, people just got out of the way quite cordially, and we did not begrudge them whatever luxury they found in that concrete sill. But over time, it became a gathering place, and the garbage collected, and the neighbors complained. And so it was necessary to say, we can't let this happen, we can't let it continue. Since then, it has come to light that the reason they were there wasn't because it's a particularly good place to be shielded from the weather, but because we had a live outlet and they could recharge their batteries of their cell phones and their iPads or their other computers, maybe even watch videos. They had a connection, and that's what they needed. And one of the things I have learned in the few weeks that I have been focused on this and have not come close to the level of expertise that, for instance, Patty has about this population, I have learned that to the homeless, one of the big important factors is not just shelter, but a sense of belonging to a community. And even if they don't originate here, even if they came from someplace else and have wandered into our place, it doesn't mean they shouldn't be greeted just as much, with just as much legitimacy as somebody who pulled up in a moving van. It's a difficult thing to understand, and it's an extremely difficult problem to comprehend, partly because the solution appears to be one house per person or family. That's a very, very expensive proposition. But what I would like to do today is to talk about, first of all, what it means to be homeless, how it is that we have this category in our minds that some person is homeless, whereas somebody who is off on a yacht for a year is not homeless. Somebody who joins the Navy is not homeless. The Bianconis right now are off camping in the woods. They're not homeless, but if they were camping out here, they would be. And so it is sort of an artificial category of that we apply to people when we say they're homeless. How did we get to here? How did we get to a point where we see people as homeless? And what I am trying to do myself is to shed some of the presumptions that lead us to considering people to be without something that they're supposed to have. And it's not just shelter, it's participation in a very expensive housing market. Right now, the vacancy rate in our neck of the woods is around 0.5%, which is the equivalent of a shortage. It is a terrible shortage. And it's driving up prices. And we get here because we have land use plans. And those land use plans come out of a long tradition of urban planning and land use planning that I studied for a little while, and I mean, I don't want to talk in a fashion that makes it appear that I don't have some enthusiasm for what it takes to put up a development. I myself have been in my previous life responsible for one or two, not solely responsible, but instrumental in their creation. I took what was supposed to be the most difficult course at Wharton in real estate development, where they would every week fly in a new major national developer, and we would look at a current project, and we would have to come up with the same reports that they would demand of their own staff. And it was, for me, a real challenge to my ability to avoid work. But I don't mean to deprecate the energy that goes into building things. It's just that the way that we have constructed it is so much different from the way that we should have. It's still based upon the evacuation of the cities back in the post-World War II era, when there was a huge blossoming of suburbs, a massive building of highways, all in pursuit of a sometimes explicit and sometimes implied desire to avoid the people who are moving into the city, who are not always the same color as the people in the neighborhoods they moved into. It's always been a problem, of course. Neighborhoods get taken over by ethnic groups because they like to speak together, and then you end up with Hungarian neighborhoods in New York and Italian neighborhoods and Polish neighborhoods and Slavic neighborhoods. And there's always a little bit of tension there, but what happened with the flight to the suburbs was that the entire government got behind the proposition that housing should be expensive. We created a life course for everybody, where when you're young, you buy a house, you sign a 30-year mortgage. This commits you to having an income for those 30 years. If that lapses, you're in big trouble. You lose your house. It means over time, it worked very well for the first generation or two because the houses appreciated in value. But what that meant was that there was a huge transfer of wealth from the young to the old. And nowadays, young people have to essentially commit to payments that max out their borrowing ability simply to get into an ordinary house. And they do it in an economy where the lifespan of a career has gotten really quite short. What you may know now, what you may be an expert in, may be replaced by a better technology, may be sent overseas to cheaper labor pools. And then what are you going to do? You can no longer afford to have the same house that you've been living in. Now, for better or for worse, and whether they did it deliberately or not, I don't know, but China is in a much better situation that way, because they committed to overbuilding. High prices for houses were not a government objective. Housing for as many people as possible, that was the government objective. And they're doing a pretty good job of it. There are many vacant apartments in China today. That wasn't the case. I mean, I haven't been there in 20 years, but I remember them just putting them up, huge, huge, mile after mile after mile of apartment blocks, and you would look down and they would seem to go on for 1 or 2 kilometers. And we continue to have a land planning program that requires that you have a permit, and it's usually a permit for one dwelling on one space. And if you're a developer, you have that one permit. You only get to build one house. So the house you're going to build is the biggest possible house you can sell. It's not going to be a house that someone who's 22 and paying off college loans can afford to get into. And as a result, we have huge amount of excess housing capacity held by people who don't need it. We have many second homes owned by people who don't need it. Many homes in our major metropolitan areas that are owned by foreigners who merely own them because they can. And you ask yourself, well, how did we get here? And it's a very long story, and I probably shouldn't try to tell the whole thing in the next 10 minutes, but we have this whole attitude about land. We see land, and it's, when you're a developer, you see land, and it might as well be a map. It's completely blank. When the Europeans landed on these shores, they weren't bare, they weren't empty. They were full of foliage and animals and humans. But what they wanted was the land. Take away all the life. You can ignore that. You can cut it down. You can burn it. You can chase it away. And that attitude persists now. When you buy a piece of property, the primary thing you get out of that is the right to exclude others. And what we have done is we have taken that right to exclude others to an extreme. And we have created whole neighborhoods, gated communities, where excluding others is the major thing that you're doing. Are you really enjoying life? Are you really part of a community? That doesn't seem to matter. What you have is this protected asset that stands up there and essentially says, this is my realm on behalf of the owner. It's very much a very old, old, old need for territory that goes back to the days when lords were not allowed to leave land to any but their first sons. And people started leaving for other continents looking for places that they could conquer so they could have land too, all the secondary members, all the second sons of British royalty, British nobility. Anyway, there we are. But the thing that is easiest for us to fix about homelessness is acceptance, is an understanding that these are members of our community. And when I go to these meetings on Friday morning, which are meetings put on by homeless people, about homeless people, and many political operators from the city go there. Most of the major charities and public agencies that deal with homeless are represented there. And they talk about this. They talk about there a real need not just to be sheltered, which is a real problem, but the truth is you can put up a tent, right? That's shelter. But we don't allow that because it violates our land use. It changes the character of the community. The character of the community, something that Jane Jacobs, the great urban planner from New York, sort of was a champion of, but she was protecting these dense neighborhoods of European immigrants from major highways that were going to slice right through southern Manhattan. She didn't prevent Robert Moses from going right through the Bronx and really destroying that whole area so that people couldn't even go and visit their mother-in-law anymore because she was now six lanes of highway away and there was no crossing, no pedestrian crossing, and destroyed it. But now that same, oh, we're trying to preserve the nature of the community, is applied to tract housing in California. And so now ordinary houses are going for millions of dollars because of that. So there are some things, other things that we can do. One of them is that we can take away the power of the local authorities to prevent charitable organizations from providing shelter. This is what happens. It actually does. There's a the community action in Burlington is perfectly willing to open up what they call a day shelter, where people who are homeless can spend their days. But the city of Burlington, town of Burlington, whatever, has forbidden it. The Seventh-day Adventists have a shelter which they are not allowed to open when the weather's fine. There has to be a weather emergency for them to be able to open it. Well, if you're worried about emergencies, homelessness is an emergency. It's an emergency every single day. You see homeless people when they seem deranged. Well, who wouldn't be without having a place to stay, having had to walk away from almost all your possessions, not having a way to reach your family, not being able to fill out a job application because you can't put an address down, not having a place where you can take a shower regularly. These are really terrible, traumatic conditions for a human being to have to suffer. A lot of what people moralize about homelessness is actually a consequence of homelessness. The drug use, for instance. More people become drug users as a consequence of being homeless than become homeless because they are drug users. Unless you're talking about people who use methamphetamines, they tend to get addicted because they take them because they're afraid to fall asleep at night, because they're afraid they don't feel safe. So they take it to stay up all night, and then they end up getting addicted. But the chance of your going for 6 months without developing a serious traumatic disorder are very low. So I composed a ballot initiative which would take away from the local authorities the power to regulate in any way a charity who is willing to give shelter to a homeless person. I'll hand out copies of it. I handed it out at this meeting for the homeless, and it was very well received. It is there's a very large coalition of organizations called the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance, which is an alliance of more than 100 other subsidiary organizations. Could you just take some of these and pass them? Thank you. Pass this around. Yeah. Anyway, this organization is willing to back the initiative. I don't know that they're necessarily committed to the wording which I came up with. And by the way, I have to thank Laura Herman and Iola Radcliffe, both for making very good suggestions of things to cut. The verbiage is all mine. Some of the stuff that's missing is probably is much better not being there.
It's
an enormous, the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance is very effective at lobbying, and they've never done one of these, a ballot initiative. It requires 325,000 signatures to get on the ballot statewide. So that is an expensive challenge for them, and it's really the expense that's worrying them. And I, on the other hand, do not believe that it is something that the legislature could pass, because the legislature derives from the local political organizations, and I don't think that there are enough legislators are going to be willing to take power away and authority away from their friends back in the county and city and municipal governments. And I was told by one of our city council members that just the threat of this is having a very good impact on the kinds of decisions that the city is making, which by the way, I can't really say that Washington State has done a bad job trying to accommodate homelessness and deal with it, but there's no getting around the fact that you still need expensive housing to solve the problem. And unless you are willing to attack that core, very deep, massive social project which we seem to have adopted, then you will always be creating more and more and more homeless people. Anyway, this is a an attempt to cool the flames a little bit by allowing charitable organizations, first of all, no excuse for not offering shelter, and secondly, no interference from local governments. Because right now what happens is that politicians get gold stars for voting for slight accommodations, and they really shouldn't be getting gold stars for anything because they're actually standing in the way. And the third point I wanted to make was one which I will just rush through. I myself have never really felt at home anywhere. I don't really know what that means. I mean, I have an idea what that means because I have relatives who've been living on the same farm for generations after generation. Back, they still resent not having slaves. And that's true. And their idea of home reminds me too many times of the countries where I grew up, where the people I was surrounding with were destabilizing. And a few years after we left, all of a sudden the government would fall, and there would be all these refugees, most of them upper class, escaping revolutions that we usually didn't intend, but which we caused. Although in places like South America or Central America, many times they're refugees from our own activities. And we have them at the border now. They're always there. And we ourselves, right now, see ourselves, our own intelligence services tell us that we ourselves are being attacked. And we are now facing a very brittle civic peace that has on one side heavily armed, enraged people who read foreign developed propaganda. Well, we've played that game ourselves, so we can't really be surprised that it's being played on us. But on the other hand, we don't really have a way to counter it yet. But my point is just that mobility is essential. Sometimes if you have a home in Detroit, yeah, you can get a cheap home in Detroit, but you can't get a job. But you can't move your house. You can't afford the houses in San Francisco. So what do you do? Well, I've lived in many different kinds of accommodations, and I actually spent a good number of months living in a motorhome. And, well, the closest I've ever felt to being home was sitting in an airline seat at takeoff when I'm leaving a place that really made me feel uncomfortable. And I feel those jet engines pouring energy into me, I feel an artificial gravity pulling me back into the seat. I'm leaving, and that's me. That is the best feeling I have, the best equivalent I have for being home, knowing that I can go someplace else. Not a very common feeling I think in our country now, but I think it is one which over time will become the standard, because we can't really just map one lot, one person. We can't do that. Humans are dynamic, careers are dynamic. And what we need to do is to treat the human as a dynamic thing. And I know that RVs right now are not in particularly good graces with most people, but the truth is that people who cannot afford or cannot find, even if they could afford, an apartment here, can swing an RV. The problem is they can't put it anywhere because the restrictions are there. And the restrictions are there specifically to prevent people like them from being around. And I actually had a couple conversations with Richard Brocksmith, who's on the city council here, about that. And first of all, they have, for the first time in a long time, created a permit for a new RV park to open up in the Mount Vernon area. And I don't know whether he's going to take me seriously with this or not, but there's a tax. There's part of the sales tax that the city can simply claim. It's not a raise in the tax. They can just say, don't send the money to the state, send it to us. It's not very much. Capitalized, it'll add up to $5 million over the course of 20 years, which you can get in it, right? You can get the whole $5 million, but you have to sort of get rid of the, you won't be able to see another cent of it because it's all going to go to the municipal bonds people. But $5 million doesn't really buy you very much in the way of housing in this town. But it would buy you a lot of stations to park RVs. And I think that the only reason that isn't a good idea for the land planners is because they don't have that idea of a house that you wear like a jacket, of being mobile, of being able to get to leave a place you can fall to. Because the truth of the matter is, what makes them homeless is because they can't live in their RVs. They can't live in their cars. They can't get shelter from the church. These are all regulations, rules that we apply to them. And we have to start taking responsibility for the way we think about them. I think that they stop being homeless and they start being people with particular problems. They can afford this, but not that. But the truth is, this is capitalism, you know. If you can get away with a lower cost, go for it. I know that I know many extremely wealthy people in New Jersey who live in tiny little houses because their grandparents lost it all and they're never going to let that happen to them. And so they are frugal to the extreme, and they would, if they had the opportunity to, they would move into one of these luxurious mobile homes. I know my grandparents, they lost the farm because my uncle had them co-sign a loan for his truck, and his truck burned down, and the insurance company investigated and decided it wasn't really a legitimate claim. So they lost the farm, and so they moved into an Airstream. And when I flew back from Tehran and went to visit them, I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I just think that it's just great that you can have this tidy little thing that has all the requirements of life right there. Anyway, I know that's a stretch for most people to try to catch up to. But I think that if we just understand that people need connection, that we need to remove the restrictions from charitable organizations that prevent taking care of the need for shelter, which is a very basic and simple need that can be taken care of. And if in the long run we really change our attitude about land use and about the mobility of housing, that we will, without having to to figure out how we can have one group of people who are totally subsidized for their housing and everyone else who's paying ridiculous amounts of money for housing. That's not a sustainable public policy over the long run, because they're going to have conflict between this pool over here and this pool over here. And this pool over here is only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's going to be resentment on the part of the people who are hoping to sell their houses for a lot of money when the government, at the same time that it's encouraging them to borrow and borrow and borrow, partly because they're buying up all the mortgages, the government's buying up all the mortgages themselves anyway. And then they have another group of people who are on public subsidy. That is not that is not something that is sustainable over the long run. I actually got into this because Bob Helton was normally going to our city council meetings, and I guess on occasion reporting to the Covenant Circle what was going on there. And then Elmira, when Bob couldn't make it, gave me a call and said, "Are you going to go?" And I said, "I'll go if you go." So we went off together to this this city council meeting where they were discussing extending this emergency ordinance. And I was never intending to say anything, but I did get up and speak and said, "Hey, you know, we're putting up signs now that say no trespassing. This is anathema to us. We have chain link fencing across the front of our property to keep out the homeless people. So don't think that because you're saying these people can't stay in this place, that those people go away. What happens is you create a huge contest for sending them elsewhere, and you completely change the nature of the neighborhood. So don't think that you're escaping land planning by doing something like that." Anyway, the head of the League of Women Voters was in the room, and she invited me to go to these meetings, and so I found myself composing a ballot initiative the next day. So there we are. So let's sing one last hymn, and then we'll do our extinguishing of the chalice. Hymn number 186. So let's flip to section 552 in our books, and we'll do a closing reading. 552, "My help is in the mountain." I'll read the regular letters, and you can read the italics. "My help is in the mountain, where I take myself to heal the earthly wounds that people give to me.
I find your love.
So I must stay for a long time until I have grown from the rock. Then I know that nothing touches me, nor makes me run away. So, let's form a circle and sing our circle song with the words up here on the wall.
From there.